Read and hear more about important news, events, and public policy debates at ncnewsline.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome to News and Views. I'm your host, Rob Schofield. Well, the North Carolina Super Tuesday primary election has finally come and gone, and now it's full speed ahead for the next 8 months to the November election. For better or worse, voters should have very little trouble distinguishing the major party candidates. As I learned earlier this week in a conversation I had with Western Carolina University political scientist Professor Chris Cooper, thanks to victories of the Trump wing of the Republican Party that ousted more traditional conservatives in race after race, governor, lieutenant governor, congressional seats, and, of course, the presidency, the contrast in the visions espoused by the candidates who will be on the ballot for this fall's general election could scarcely be wider. Well, Professor Chris Cooper, welcome back to News and Views. Good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we're talking the morning after, just after Super Tuesday, another interesting election. Of course, North Carolina, one of the few states that had so many things on the ballot on Super Tuesday. Lots of things to discuss, but what are your overall immediate takeaways from what we saw on Super Tuesday?
That it was a pretty fascinating night, right? Not at the top of the ticket. We knew what was going to happen, and it's exactly what happened, right? I mean, it's going to be Biden and Trump. That's not that interesting. But I think the sort of repudiation of establishment Republican candidates was a pretty big deal. So races like Secretary of Labor, John Hardister, of course, member of the North Carolina General Assembly, not one of the more extreme members,
right,
lost, didn't make it to a runoff. Deanna Ballard, who used to be in the General Assembly, of course, did not make it very far at all in the LG race. Well, she won't be part of the runoff. People like Gray Mills running for Congress, people like John Bradford running for Congress, these like former members of the General Assembly, good conservatives, establishment folks who moved up the ranks. They lost, and they lost pretty big in some cases.
Probably the most high profile of those upsets came in the state superintendent's race, where we had an incumbent Republican, Catherine Truitt, been there for 4 years, been very loyal to the party, has had the endorsement of the powers that be in the Republican Party, and has pretty much towed the line on the culture war issues. But apparently it wasn't enough for some of the voters in the Republican primary there.
Yeah, and that one too. You look at the fundraising numbers, and she was outraised, like 8-1. She's a
Michelle Morrow, the victor, that is.
Yes, exactly. The victor was outraised 8-1, more than 8-1, actually. And against the incumbent was way up, and yet the challenger wins, who raised less than $100,000. I mean, this was a pretty big upset, and I think a sense of where the grassroots of the Republican Party is today. Like some folks, including me, thought that all these unaffiliated voters choosing the Republican primary might moderate a bit. That was not borne out in reality.
But the overall turnout, probably not one of the highest we've seen, was around 24%. Is that right? So does that mean maybe it's the most passionate people, the folks probably who are more ideologically inclined, who might be more likely to hold sway? And maybe that explains some of this?
I think that probably does explain some of it, right? I mean, look, the top of the ticket, again, was decided on both parties ahead of time. Even the gubernatorial race, which was a little bit more competitive, still pretty much decided. So if you were going to turn out to vote, you had to care about things like superintendent of education. Incredibly important, don't misread me, but not exactly on the tip of most voters' tongues.
That's going to be a fascinating race in the fall. Michelle Morrow, the victor, a stay-at-home mom, homeschool teacher, you know, a Moms for Liberty devotee, against Mo Green, a Democrat who has been a school superintendent, head of a progressive foundation, won handily in the Democratic primary. There'll be a real debate about the future of the Department of Public Instruction in North Carolina going forward.
Yeah, and about education in general. And I see this one leaning into the culture wars issues. Certainly Morrow's shown that she's willing to do that, happy to do that. I expect her to continue to do that. So much like the AG race, much like the governor's race, this is a purple state with candidates that are anything but purple.
Well, let's go back to the top of the ticket. Some people have suggested maybe there's a bit of an enthusiasm gap for President Biden, although I guess the no preference votes that were cast in his race were actually lower, I think, than Barack Obama in 2012. So, he did win close to 90% of the vote. Does he have any chance of getting within shouting distance of Donald Trump this fall?
Yeah, I think he definitely has a chance of getting shouting distance to Donald Trump in the fall. You know, if you made me bet, and thank goodness you won't, but if you did, yeah, I would say, look, Trump is probably the favorite at this very early stage in North Carolina. but it's incredibly early. It is a purple state. Of all the states that Trump won in 2020, his margin was the smallest in North Carolina of any of them. We are the least red of all the red states in America.
In the governor's race, again, a sharp contrast, a Trump-endorsed Republican and Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, Attorney General Josh Stein, traditional Democrat working his way up the ranks. I'm assuming we're just going to be blitzed with attack ads on Robinson. Just, it's such a target-rich environment. So many comments and statements he's made. Presumably won't be very persuasive with his devoted following, but with unaffiliated, I assume that may be a big part of Stein's plan going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if Robinson somehow didn't win, right? So if in some alternate universe, Dale Falwell ended up pulling that out or Bill Graham, I don't know what Josh Stein would have done, because pretty clearly he's been smartly running against Mark Robinson from the beginning. So I expect to see that continue. I think this is going to be a nasty one. I think it's going to be incredibly close in a state like North Carolina. Stein, on one hand, you say, well, his rhetoric's less extreme than Robinson, and he kind of comes out of the Roy Cooper mold. But unlike Roy Cooper, he's not from rural North Carolina. And so I think the sort of the secret sauce of Roy Cooper was that he didn't stop the bleeding in rural North Carolina, but he slowed it down a little bit. And that and running up the totals in the metros enabled him to squeak out victories. Can Josh Stein do the same thing? I think it remains to be seen.
Another race you alluded to, of course, the race for attorney general, where we'll have also a similar ideological contrast. And there was an interesting wrinkle to that, in that the Republicans, national Republicans, seemed to have identified Congressman Jeff Jackson, who ended up winning, as someone they really didn't want to run against, and spent a lot of money trying to lift up a very progressive opponent that he had in the Democratic primary.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There were a couple of examples in this primary of the Republican Party or people affiliated with the Republican Party and conservative causes putting in for more for Democratic candidates that they would prefer to face. And so we saw that with Santana DeBerry. And yeah. I think the General Assembly side, we saw the Republican Party try to double down and get some of those establishment Democrats to perhaps be able to squeak out victories in the General Assembly. So some really interesting kind of strategic action on the Republican Party getting involved in Democratic primaries.
But presumably Jackson versus Dan Bishop, a pair of Charlotte area congressmen running for attorney general. Again, very sharp ideological differences, presumably a close race also in the fall.
Yeah, I think absolutely a close race. Let's remember Josh Stein is our current attorney general, and his margin was almost infinitesimally small. Right. You could barely see through that margin. So, yeah, I expect to see something pretty similar. This is going to be another scorched earth race. I think this is going to be the most expensive attorney general race in North Carolina history, perhaps in American history. Not too often that major national media outlets are going to pay attention to a state attorney general race. I think this one will be the exception to that rule.
Yeah, Jackson sort of seen as an up-and-coming potential star in the Democratic Party, and Dan Bishop, of course, the author of the famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, HB2 bathroom bill. Yeah, it seems almost a certainty. Another fascinating race, as we look at some of the congressional races, is the revival of Mark Harris. What's it been now, 6 years since he was the scandal that took him out of the 2018 race for the 9th district. He's now the 8th district nominee for the Republicans. It looks like he just eked it out with a little over 30% of the vote. This is the Reverend Mark Harris.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And let's remember this. The threshold in North Carolina is 30% plus one vote to escape a runoff, or as we call it here, a second primary. Mark Harris barely squeaked that out. So he had a pretty small victory and he narrowly got over that 30% mark, unlike folks in the 6th congressional district and the 13th congressional district that will go to this May 14th runoff.
Yeah, I was going to say we've got a handful of runoffs. I guess the challengers technically have to ask for that runoff. The second place finishers, is that how it works?
That's correct. And every now and again, they don't, right? So we had an example on the Democratic side for lieutenant governor just a few years ago where somebody did not call for one when they could have. Right. It looks like, I think early reports I've seen say that Brad Nott in the 13th has already gone ahead and called for the second primary. I think in the auditor's race, there's some signs that that will be a second primary as well. So it seems likely they're going to end up with 4 second primaries on the Republican side for very prominent offices, right? 2 for Congress and 2 for our Council of State. That is highly unusual. It's never happened with that kind of number since we dropped the runoff threshold to 30%.
Coming up next, part 2 of my conversation with Professor Chris Cooper. Don't go away.
Read and hear more about important news, events, and public policy debates at ncnewsline.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. In part one of my post-Super Tuesday primary election conversation with Western Carolina University political scientist Chris Cooper, we discussed how Tuesday's election results have abetted the ongoing hard right turn of the state's Republican Party, along with career-ending defeats for several prominent GOP officials and incumbents who had ambitions for rising up the political ladder. In part two of our chat, we continued our discussion of this theme and looked at some surprising outcomes in the state legislature. We also examined the fact that at least four GOP races in crowded primaries, including two races for Congress, will be headed to low turnout May runoffs, elections in which just a tiny number of voters will wield enormous power to pick the ultimate winners.
Talking here about the fact that we're going to have some runoffs, these are pretty important, particularly in the congressional side, because basically the winners of the Republican primaries in almost every one of these is they win, right? They're going to win in November.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So today, you know, as we talk on March 6th, we have seven congressional delegations, seven Democrats, seven Republicans. That's going to change thanks to these new maps. And did I say new maps? Yes, I did once again, right? So we're going to end up almost certainly with 10 Republicans, with three Democrats, and with one question mark in the northeastern corner of the state, that congressional district one currently held by Democrat Don Davis. And so the outcome of this second primary in 13 and in six being Greensboro area, 13 kind of in a reverse C around Wake County, the winner of those is almost certainly going to be the winner come November.
We had 24% turnout in this primary. It's right. Going to be a lot less in the runoff, maybe a fraction of that, right?
It is. So I ran some data in the last few years since we changed it to 30%. We tend to see about half of the primary turnout in the second primary. So Put all that together, what does it mean? It means we're going to be certainly below 20% total turnout in that second primary.
You sweep your immediate circle of friends and family, and maybe you're a member of Congress.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And let's keep in mind, in the six, you know, Donald Trump has gotten involved in that election and, of course, endorsed Addison McDowell. I think the big question mark there was whether McDowell would be able to get that word out. He didn't raise a ton of money, frankly. Well, now he's got some extra runway to get that word out. I have a feeling he'll be successful.
And in the lieutenant governor runoff for the Republicans, nobody even got 20%, if I'm right, or maybe somebody barely eked out 20%. The two candidates are Hal Weatherman, who's a former staffer for Sue Myrick, and her son, Dan Forrest, and I believe even Madison Cawthorn, right, at one
correct.
Point? He's pretty much a fire breather, and I'm blanking it for the moment as to who he'll be running against in the Republican runoff for lieutenant governor.
It's another really kind of MAGA affiliated candidate who's going to be there. We had 11 folks running for that office. So it's Jim O'Neill is the vote getter. Hal Weatherman below 20% with the most. So that's going to be another interesting one. Let's keep in mind the lieutenant governor doesn't have a lot of power. It's kind of an office in search of a responsibility. But at the same time, it means something, I think, ultimately just for how people think they're represented, even if that representation doesn't play out in terms of legislation.
Of course, Jim O'Neill is a Forsyth County prosecutor who was previously a nominee for attorney general, so he's working his way through various council of state offices, it would appear. Supreme Court Justice Allison Riggs rather easily prevailed over her challenger, but she'll presumably have a very tough race in the fall where these North Carolina pretty evenly divided in how we vote on judicial races, and they're so far down the ballot, I guess some people don't even get to them when they vote in November.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the best case scenario for the Democrats is they could take the court back over, and I believe it's 2028. If things go well, one thing they need to go perfectly is to reelect the person who they recently appointed to this position. Riggs, of course, is filling the seat vacated by Mike Morgan, who stepped down to run and ultimately lose for governor.
And of course, House Speaker Tim Moore, as he predicted, looks like he is pretty much a shoo-in to become a congressman next year. The district that he and his colleagues drew for his congressional run, the new 14th district, he easily defeated two other candidates.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so many interesting little machinations in that district. One was Pat Harrigan was running for a time against Tim Moore, and then Harrigan decided that instead he would run in the 10th when Patrick McHenry, temporary speaker, right, decided to lay down his literal and figurative gavel and retire from Congress. So Harrigan then moved up north. Well, actually ran where he lived, to be frank. He decided he'd run in the 10th, and he beat Gray Mills in that seat. So what would have happened in this alternate universe? We ran against Moore. We'll never know. They may end up ultimately serving together in Congress. Actually, almost certain to.
Yeah, it's funny how politicians who sometimes are mortal enemies can become the best of friends when they're in different districts. That seems entirely plausible. Some interesting races in the legislature. There were a handful of surprises, I suppose. One was there was a college student seems to have won a race. That's, as I understand it, Wyatt Gable, an East Carolina University junior, narrowly defeating veteran incumbent George Cleveland, who's a sort of made his mark over 20 years as one of the most vociferous anti-immigration Republicans in the General Assembly. That's rather a surprising outcome, I suppose.
It's an incredibly surprising outcome. I would imagine that's going to inspire maybe some additional conversations about college student voting in and around Pitt County. We'll see if that prediction is borne out in reality, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised. I haven't looked at the data yet. It's a little too soon. My guess is this ECU student did really well in and around ECU, not surprisingly. Mm-hmm. And so that probably, almost certainly, really pushed the tide against this establishment Republican figure who's been in for a while. So I'd be curious to see if there's any couple of eyeballs that go towards college student voting for the Republican Party.
And then there was Mike Woodard, a veteran Durham Democratic senator who actually tried to run for mayor at one point of Durham last year. And then he's had some criticism for sometimes making nice with Republicans in the Senate, soundly defeated by a newcomer in the Durham Democratic primary.
Yeah, it was a bad day, bad night to be an establishment figure on either side. So, yeah, Mike Woodard has served a good while in the North Carolina State Senate, kind of a fixture. Durham has definitely moved left in the time that Mike Woodard has been in office. I think he stayed put. He has been a rare voice that will work across the aisle. Well, that's good or bad. Well, it seems like the primary voters in Durham ultimately thought, well, that's not so good.
Bottom line, it's a fascinating time in North Carolina politics. We're so glad you're helping us keep track of it. Folks want to follow you on Twitter or websites. Where should they look to track you on the internet, Chris?
Yeah, most of the places you can be tracked. I'm at Chris Cooper WCU, so I better never leave my university. I'll be in big branding trouble. But I'm on Twitter, Chris Cooper WCU. I've got a website, ChrisCooperWCU.com. And if there's another social media next week, I'll probably, against my better judgment, join that one as well with the same handle.
Chris Cooper is a professor of political science and public affairs at Western Carolina University and director of the Public Policy Institute there. Chris, thanks so much. Get some rest. And maybe next time we'll talk, we'll both be a little clearer-eyed and it won't be the morning after.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Coming up next, a look at a troubling new national assessment of what some decisions of the General Assembly are doing to our state's public schools. Stay with us.